I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I thank you for joining us. Now in the studio with me, looking very excited, it's Alison Rudd. And down the line, it's the very excellent Matt Dickinson. Later on, we'll be discussing Gareth Southgate's England World Cup squad and the identity of the next Arsenal manager. But there's only one place to start, and that's at Wembley with the FA Cup final. Dicko, I want to start before the game. Romelu Lukaku's had a very good season. I couldn't work out. Then he had an injury, and so he came off the bench. Can you work out what Mourinho said about him? And he's like, if the player tells me he's not fit, then I can't play him. And what's he doing?
Well, as in many cases with Mourinho, certainly increasingly in recent years, you're less sort of scratching your head thinking, well, you know, we do know, you know, it's not the first time he'd have prodded a player in public to try and get something out of them, but to do it at the close of season, to do it, whether it's him just sort of saying, you know, don't blame me for this one, blame someone else, which again wouldn't be the first time he's done that either. But it just doesn't make sense. And as you say, I still find Lukaku a bit frustrating in the sense that he, you know, I think he can be better better than he has been. I think his talents suggest there's much more to come.
It was a fitness thing, right?
Well, but yeah, equally, as you say, there's been a discussion about whether he feels fit to play. I mean, I know it's a recurring theme with Mourinho, this as well, about this issue of sort of getting players out when they're not right. I mean, he can be pretty unsparing on players he feels are malingering, but the emphasis there on he feels, and I just don't think this is a clever row to bring out into public at the end of a season. I just don't think it's, you know, once again, this leaves you scratching your head about how he thinks he's getting the best out of players, and because he's not. I mean, that's ultimately the manager's job, and you know, Paul Pogba is having issues. I mean, Paul Pogba is another one. He's over-elaborating. His head is not quite right. Marcus Rashford, he is not the player he should be. You know, if this was a one-off, you'd say it's the player's problem. But when it becomes two, three, four players, you start thinking, is this the manager's problem?
Alison, we in the media get blamed for creating speculation and controversy and stuff like that. This, to me, seems pretty open and shut, though. He could have just said he's not fully fit. That's why he's starting on the bench. He can give us 25 minutes, half an hour, but I can't start him because he's not fit. And that would have been the easy out. By speaking the way he did, well, he says he's not fit, blah, blah, blah. You're leaving yourself open to the fact that this guy's a wuss or that he's saving himself for the World Cup or all this other stuff. What's the point?
I think, if there is a point, it's Mourinho's way of saying, woe is me, look at what I've had to deal with all season.
Yeah, but this guy's been good for Mourinho this season. This guy's scored
a
ton of goals.
I would say it's not a specific Lukaku thing. I would say it's an exasperation that he's going into his only chance to win silverware this season and he doesn't feel the team are clicking. He hasn't quite got on top of the problems he has there. He feels slighted that coming second to a team like City hasn't been awarded the praise he feels he should get. He clearly has a bad feeling about the preparation because he's getting his excuses in early. I wouldn't say it was a specific, like he's been simmering with issues with Lukaku all season necessarily. I just feel Mourinho doesn't believe his team are as malleable as teams he's had in the past. He's found it hard to be as pragmatic with them. He can't mould them the way he wants to mould them, and it's become a bit of a mishmash. And in fact, what happened was the FA Cup final was a prime example of everything that has been unacceptable or unappealing about Manchester United this season, because there was very little, especially in the first half, where you could identify what was happening. It was a bit of a mess.
Why don't we get to that later? I mean, let's review some of these incidents, because the one, obviously, Chelsea took the lead with that early Eden Hazard penalty. Ball over the top. Phil Jones, who then... I kind of feel for the guy, because he really is set up to be like... It almost seems like, why always him, you know, with that bizarre own goal. And then here, like, he's... You know, it's hard. It's hard when you're like that and you're coming from the other direction, and Hazard has you beat. He fouls him. He's not sent off. Conte's head explodes on the bench. This is pretty open and shut, right? Alisson, qualified referee. The rules changed. Yeah. And as long as you make a genuine attempt to play the ball in the box, in other words, not if you do the Trent Alexander-Arnold handball in Rome, or if you jump on somebody's head and tackle him, if it's inside the box, if it's a genuine attempt to play the ball, there is no so-called triple punishment. You get a yellow. If it's outside the box, where the thinking is, even if it's a genuine attempt, you've got time to recover potentially, then you can get a red card. But inside the box, it's a yellow. That's what the rule says.
And everyone welcomed that rule change, because it did seem terribly unfair to be given a penalty against you for a tackle that just was mistimed.
Did you think it was a genuine... Do you think it was a mistimed... I mean, you think... I was actually thinking, this is the other argument somebody made, is maybe people are like, oh, look, Conte's so thick, he doesn't know the rule. But actually, people say maybe he does know the rule, maybe... He didn't think it was a genuine attempt to play the ball, because it looks like a normal tackle. But is there any way, shape, or form, other than turning himself into Gumby or Captain Fantastic, that he can actually get the ball cleanly?
Probably not, but he was only inches away from it. It wasn't like... It was close enough, I think.
Hazard senses that, you know, Hazard does exactly what he should do, which is just, you know, shift fractionally so that he is... You know, he's in the way of the ball, but as you know, I think Jones is reaching that point where he's thinking, you know, I'm going to have to try and sort of do a reach around tackle now. Although he said he should have gone obviously with his left foot, but I think at that point Hazard is also, you know, he knows someone's on his shoulder and is sort of making sure if a tackle comes, the tackle hits him. So you know, it was a desperate tackle, but I think. Yeah, I think blindly we got, you know, we talk about this enough. If you can understand why the referee's done it, which I think anyone sensibly can, you know, thinks that's a, you know, and he was in a, again, I thought it was brilliant to watch how Michael Oliver changes his run, just comes across by a few yards so that he's exactly the right line behind. You know, you can understand his decision, absolutely.
All right, I understand that one, and I think spot on. What I understood a little bit less, especially with VAR, was Ashley Young's handball. Is he suggesting that this is obviously in the second half? I think it was Victor Moses who tries to put in a cross after a brilliant counterattack from Chelsea, which I did with Marcos Alonso, clearly being extremely one-footed. But what was your thought on that, Alison?
That was 100% not handball. I'm surprised it created quite as much debate. The ball was travelling at speed very close to Ashley Young. If he had tried to move his arm out of the way, he could have still clipped the ball. Then it would have been a penalty because he would have been moving his arm. So he didn't make any unnatural movement. He was close because he's supposed to be, because he's trying to block a cross or a shot. I don't see at that distance, at that speed, how... a player with his arms by his side. His body moves forward, therefore his arms move slightly forward. But you really can't expect players in the box to be working out the angles of their limbs in an absolute split second. I don't think it was a penalty at all.
Could have done the old thing where you keep your arms behind your...
There wasn't time. It was all very fast. It was close range and fast.
Dicko?
Yeah, I'm agreed.
Oh, come on. I don't know.
What do you think?
You Italians, you just can't take Michael Oliver, can you?
No. No, I just thought it was, I don't know, I didn't think the ball was traveling at such speed. It looked more like It looked more like he chipped it, actually.
It was so close. I agree
it was close. I'm assuming it went to and I'm assuming it's not even Michael Oliver's call. Michael Oliver might have seen it, not seen it. I'm assuming VAR got in his ear and said, oh, look, yeah, it was close.
Well, I think he sees it, and he thinks that's not a penalty, and unless the guy thinks that that's a, you know, he's got it horribly wrong, and it's definitely a penalty, then he says, yeah, no, you know, I think you probably have that right. Or it's enough to say, I think you may have that right.
Mourinho had some interesting things to say afterwards. He basically said that this is one of those situations where I don't think he's contradicting himself. I can see where he's coming from. He says, I'll always applaud the winners because I'm all about results and all about winning. And then he says, of course, only one team tried to play, presumably not the team in blue. And what would you have said about me if we had played that way and we had won? So I'm going to ask you, Dicko, what would you have said if United set up the way Chelsea did? Well, what would you have said if United had played this way?
I would have said if you're getting the best out of your best player, Eden Hazard, then, you know, you're setting up a system pretty well, aren't you? The bottom line about the way the game was set up was not what Chelsea did, but what Mourinho did. I mean, Mourinho puts Herrera on a very obvious, you know, transparent from the second of the game, Herrera's man-marking Hazard. Basically, he's done that because he doesn't want the centre-half to be drawn out of position to advance the take on Hazard, so he wants, you know, absolute belt-and-braces defence. And it didn't work. And not only that, but it conceded in the sense that obviously Hazard does wriggle free and gets the goal. It didn't work in the sense that it set a very defensive tone for United from the start. It didn't work in the sense that they were getting outnumbered in midfield, because obviously if you're pulling Herrera back, then you've got Pogba and Matic generally were up against three, so they're being outnumbered. And, you know, we could go on. So you go into half-time, you're 1-0 down. Obviously, the game then changes. United go on the front foot. They get more offensive, but Chelsea retreat. Clearly under orders, under a plan of, actually, this is just, we are just going to try and grind it out. And their defensive organisation and their general concentration is good enough to sort of get away with it. Yeah, there was a slight sense of getting away with it, but once your first half plan has worked better than the opposition's, then you've sort of got that luxury. So, I can see why Mourinho was trying to deflect it with, oh, look at them parking the bus. But I'm afraid, you know, he was the one whose first half plan didn't work. And plus, on top of that, Alexis Sanchez having an absolute stinker, Lingard anonymous, Rashford's confidence completely shot. So you haven't got that forward punch.
We've seen him go defensive. We've seen him be anything but defensive, depending on the situation. But, I mean, I think when you're 1-0 up against a team that's not very good at parking themselves in the final third and passing circles around you, i.e. Manchester United, then I think it makes sense to sit and take your chances on the counter. And said so they had that very good chance with Alonso. Mourinho's solution in these situations is simply to send on more and more strikers, right?
Yeah.
So then it's just more bodies, and then you just counter bodies with bodies, and you're fine. It's not like you take the lead and then, you know, you're playing Bayern Munich or Manchester City, and so they're going to go and camp out in your half, and then you're kind of in trouble because you're inviting the pressure, right? That's United aren't comfortable playing that way in the same way that these other teams are.
But what about the disconnect? It worked. As a plan, it worked. Absolutely, they won the cup, and it never really felt like United were going to get back in it. And as a plan, it worked. So why were the players not more joyous about executing a plan well and winning a cup? Why was Hazard saying, that wasn't enjoyable, if I need to play with more expression? What? I just felt there was...
Because it was a horrible game. I mean...
Yeah, exactly. So I felt the players were sort of going overboard on it and could have had more counterattacks, but were actually quite... deliberately, inhibitedly conservative to make a point.
You're right. Obviously, we had the whole issue with Willian's Instagram as well. For those who didn't see this, he put little are they little sort of emojis of the cup onto the team photo, and he put them to cover up Antonio Conte. Now, Alison, you were saying that this was actually a tribute to Conte because he said Conte was the man behind the cup, and without him, they wouldn't have won it, right? That's how you read it?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any debate, is there? I think this has been underplayed, the way the players have reacted. We had Fabregas and Hazard saying this is unacceptable and not fun to play in, and they doubt their futures if playing such football. You've got a really insulting posting by Willian, who, I mean, it's not nice to be left on the bench for the cup final, but it's not about that, I don't think. It's just about just being bored of the system, bored of the training, bored of being boring. But to post that is, I just think that's remarkable. This is player power surely ensuring that Conte doesn't have a chance to keep going at the club.
Which might be what Conte wants, because if he gets sacked, then he gets a ton of compensation and is free to go somewhere else.
Oh God, that's like House of Cards.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this is such an odd situation, isn't it, Dicko?
Well, that is about to fall out with Costa last summer as well, isn't it?
And David Luiz, of course.
And David Luiz.
I mean, if you're willing, you can understand. Like, oh, look, my two mates, right?
Yeah.
Gee, what happened to me this season? I think David Luiz had four games this season where he played 90 minutes.
I did think it was extraordinary that he didn't come on earlier. I mean, there was a game, this was a game where, you did sense that, say, as we said before, Chelsea were riding their luck a bit, and I was sitting so deep, and you just thought they've got to get some energy out there. I mean, Fabregas had done the pass of the game, but equally he was, in that sort of rear guard sort of action, he's not the player that you'll tend to be looking for, and you just thought they've got to get some more energy on the pitch. And I found it, I did find it perverse that William was saved so late. And imagining Conte's mind, you can, I don't know, think that there's some sort of fallout up yours about that one as well. I think there's been quite a lot of up yours about Conte generally.
What happens now, though? Because, I mean, on the background here, just to sum up, if he gets sacked, then Chelsea have to pay him a ton of money, which could be problematic because financial fair play for all the giggling, ha ha ha, it's real, and it affects a club like Chelsea. Especially when they won't have Champions League football next season, and of course didn't have Champions League football 2 years ago. If on top of that you have to go and spend what, 12 million, 11 million on his payoff.
He only signed 2 years, and he said, and if they're paying him a year's money by Chelsea standards, that's a discount sacking compared to much of what's gone before.
But then you got to pay the next guy too. So
yeah, but I don't think anyone's been working under any illusion. They did a sort of marriage of convenience last summer. Even then, it was clearly, relations have been strained for a long time, haven't they? And I just think that gets to a point, they've managed to get through this year, but, let's not forget they're out of the Champions League, but it has not been any kind of sort of harmonious working relationship for a long time. And at Chelsea, as we know, there comes a point where the big boss, doesn't indulge that anymore.
The big boss, who of course hasn't been to England since April, and it's, as news emerged yesterday, he hasn't received his visa. He doesn't have a normal. He's Russian. He only has a Russian passport, and to be in this country, he used what you call an investor visa, which is something reserved for people who invest a lot of money in this country. And it hasn't been renewed yet. Now, it hasn't been turned down either, but from what's been reported and what his people have confirmed, it has not yet been renewed. So that's just part of the reason he wasn't at the FA Cup final. Bit of an air of mystery there. And the other thing is they haven't appointed a director of football either, which seemed to be a pretty integral part of their plan. They haven't had one since Michael Imanalo left back in December, I think it was. So do they have a plan, Alison? I mean, we don't even hear them linked, do we? We had a bit of link with Luis Enrique, a little bit of a link with Sarri, then it all seems to kind of go cold. Maybe your pal Brendan Rodgers, but then that went cold.
You're right, Gab. This has been a peculiar hiatus at Chelsea. There is normally rumour. There is normally a plan, yes, and it's very hard to keep it secret. A lot of people had money on Conte being sacked straight after the final. Didn't happen. There are no leaks. You can pick up paper with people who cover Chelsea day in, day out. It's the club they look at. And those journalists, they're really good at getting it right. And they're changing their mind almost daily on who might be the new manager, what might be the new setup, how they're coping with Emanalo's departure, which is weird that they haven't coped with it yet.
Would it be insane to suggest that maybe Abramovich says, you know what, I got bigger problems. We should have appointed a director of football. We don't have one yet. Rather than going and spending a ton of money on getting a manager in and then scrambling to get a director of football, why don't I just take my time with it? Conte may have his issues, but he also still has pride. We only finished fifth. Maybe we can raise some money by selling a couple guys and we'll be fine. And we'll finish top four next year because Spurs are sure to collapse at some point. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, maybe take my time and do it right. And so Conte ends up staying. Is that like totally far-fetched? Or put Conte in a position where he has to resign?
Yeah, well, I can't see it. I just don't. I think there's too much. I guess we should never say never, but it's, you consider that, you know, someone like Willian is clearly just wants to get out. If Conte stays, other players we know are...
Sorry, but that's Willian, right? So if Willian wants to get out, he has a good World Cup, you sell him for money. It's not like Maradona's leaving.
Bigger than that, you need to want the manager. The manager has to want to stay. The manager has to want to have a plan. The manager has to want... Because they have missed the Champions League this year. And, you know, for all of Conte's... I would hope professionalism, for all of personal ambition. If a guy is that disgruntled and has been squabbling with you and so on, I think you would have to look him in the eye and say, do you have any desire to be around for another year before you could make that? And if we think that's wobbled pretty hard, and if it has, then surely you are better looking around. And Chelsea being Chelsea, with the money they have, with being in London, being with the resources, with the, you know, it's a decent playing squad, let's not forget. It's a pretty attractive option for a number of coaches.
And if there's another elephant in the room, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, which is Eden Hazard's contract, because he's entering the final 2 years, and we know that that's not a great situation. I will say this, just to wrap this up, as somebody who knows a little bit about Antonio Conte, he's generally at his best when he's angry, driven, and under-resourced. It's not a coincidence that he did his finest work in his first season at Juventus when he didn't have any of the players he wanted. I mean, he had to redraw his whole system. He grumbled the whole year about it. Or indeed, with Italy, when he had easily the worst Italy squad in more than half a century. And then, you know, took them to the quarterfinals where they drew with Germany and beat Spain along the way. I'm not so negative about this. If this is how it turns out, you could, you know, maybe Morata will develop since he's had a whole year with him and he'll contribute a little more. Maybe you raise some money from selling Willian if that's what you want to do. Maybe David Luiz as well. Everybody seems to have forgotten him. Ruben Loftus-Cheek comes back. Ross Barkley's fit. Would it really be that?
Chelsea for the title.
No, what about Ethan Ampadu?
What a great... to be honest, I'd love Conte to stay. I actually find his bloody-mindedness very interesting to watch. I like his slight craziness combined with, clearly, he is a bloody good coach. I mean, there's no two ways about it. He's if there's any part of him that wants to stay, I'd love him to stay. But I just think Chelsea, we've seen too often that fallouts, especially fallouts with the hierarchy... You don't stay around. I mean, as simple as that.
If, like me, you're feeling sad about the end of the domestic football season and the end of the game podcast, guess what? We will be podcasting every single match day during the World Cup in Russia. That's right. The game podcast will be available every day. Allison, Matt, and I will all be out in Russia on the front line, appearing on the podcast along with your other favorites, and we have a very special host here in London who will be running the show. To find out who he or she is, keep listening to the podcast over the next few weeks. Let's move to North London, where we have a story today in the game by our colleague Gary Jacob, who says that Mikel Arteta is expected to be named as Arsenal manager this week. Other reports suggest Unai Emery could be on his way. Everybody and their dog have been linked to the Arsenal job. Dick, are you buying this? What's the thinking?
I think the thinking is that, obviously they know Arteta a bit. They think he's bright. They think he's a sort of coming force as a coach, and they want to harness that. I do think there is probably other agendas in the sense that you bring in a more experienced manager who's set in his ways, and I think there's a bit of power play going on at Arsenal in the sense of a lot of moving parts, a lot of, establishing of territory between directors of football, board, ownership.
You're talking about Raul and Sven.
Yeah, that, and I just think bringing in a younger coach, they probably think he's going to be more malleable, more able to sort of, be told sort of these are the areas of demarcation, and an older guy might come in and say, well, hang on a minute, this is how I've worked for the last 20 years. So I think there's a bit of that. I think there's undoubtedly he's worked next to Pep Guardiola. Let's hope he's sprinkled with stardust, which I think is the dangerous bit of the appointment. I think, everything you hear about Arteta sort of behind the scenes, he does sound like he's got all the potential, to be very good. But no one knows. No one can be sure. No one knows, not even Arteta, what it is like to be the main man, to have to make all those decisions relentlessly, to be have staff look to you for the lead, to set that lead, to do it day after day in the right way, and not only that, to do it at a club like Arsenal where it's been fixed in one mould for 22 years, and it's a big thing to change. So I think it's a dangerous appointment, not because, say, I don't think Arteta's got talent, but just because I think you can't underestimate the scale of the job. Arsenal's a flawed team in a number of different ways, and I just think to put that in the hands of what is a managerial novice, that's a fact, he hasn't managed before, is brave, almost, not quite bordering on reckless, but it's jumping off the 10-metre board and not being sure how you're going to land, really.
I think it's weird, because undoubtedly, unless Arteta was at City, he wouldn't be considered for the job. If he was an assistant coach anywhere else, I don't think they'd think it was a leap he could make.
People say, oh, well, Arteta, he's worked under Pep. It's almost like he's the next Pep. And Rui Faria, he's worked under Jose, he's the next Jose. Well, no one knows. It's not like Rui's had the chance to sit down and say, well, actually, I've seen Jose, but I'd prefer to play a different way. Or that they know that Arteta can play the Pep way. I mean, there's massive assumptions gone into sort of these guys. Oh, well, he's worked with him, therefore he's a sort of mini-me.
But is that even an assumption you want to make? Because Arsenal are the least Manchester City-like team you've got in the Premier League in terms of...
Jose Mourinho thanks you.
No, I would say, no, I bet if, I don't know, I don't have the detailed stats in front of me, but from memory, from looking at Opta throughout the season, Arsenal do the least pressing, the least running around, the least organised, offer the most space in the most ridiculous areas, don't press on the ball, all the opposite things that City do. So if you're on the board at Arsenal and you've seen that, and you think, yeah, Wenger just let it slip. Just let energy and effort and running slip. And that discipline slip. But if only we had what they do at City, which is they have the flair, which we've always wanted at Arsenal, but you ally it to really hard work. You think that Arteta's going to do that. That's asking too much of somebody who's never been in charge before.
All right, so the other thing about Arteta we should just point out is he came through the ranks at Barcelona, and obviously Raul's background is at Barcelona, so maybe there's a common sort of mindset there as well, because obviously Arteta's been all over. The two points I want to make, two other guys who are hugely respected, two guys who we love to interview, we always say how intelligent they are, they're both midfielders. And it's Patrick Vieira, who's leaving his job at New York City FC to go, supposedly to go manage Nice. Dico, did he ever come up in the conversation for Arsenal?
Well, I think there was a sort of, they almost felt obliged to sort of do a nod to Vieira just because so many of the fans were chuntering about it. I don't think it's gone, sort of discussions went very far. And you know, the fact is, again, we're talking about, I mean, he's done, clearly, obviously done more than Arteta in the sense of he's actually managed for a couple of years. I think sort of shrewd move by City are trying to develop him and do the youth team over the younger players over there, then move to the MLS where he's had a couple of years. Just, you know, it's just experiencing what it's like to be the main man.
But why wouldn't he be ahead of Arteta?
Well, in with that logic, he should be. But I think Vieira would have been a big punt. I think he is still learning. I was over there actually for an MLS game a few weeks ago where they got spanked by Red Bull, and you could see there that would have been a massive lesson for him because they were 2-0 down after 4 minutes, just got, you know, walked into an absolute, you know, avalanche of attacks and weren't prepared for it. And whether that's players or coach, he will have learned a huge amount from that. And that's the point. You know, it's a job where there's a hell of a lot to learn. And I don't think Vieira would have been my appointment either, to be honest. Emery certainly, his record makes him an infinitely more credible candidate, it would seem. You know, I do understand, you know, Ancelotti's another one who obviously with his absolutely phenomenal record is, you know, out of work. I do understand the debate between, do you want to have someone like Ancelotti who is, you know, well, is he past his best? Does he still have the absolute desire and hunger? Necessary questions. I can understand them looking for someone who they think is sort of the coming man. But, you know, I just think you can tilt that argument too far and take someone who's lacking in experience, and you're taking a punt rather than doing something based on any kind of knowledge. And when you're a club of Arsenal size, should you be taking a punt?
You know what I'd love? And somebody threw this out there, and it's a romantic notion, but anybody here know who Arteta's next-door neighbor was growing up? We played, they're the same age, and they played football together every day. Anybody?
Go on.
I'll give you a hint. He was a far better footballer than Arteta.
Arteta.
It's a man named Xabi Alonso.
I was about to blink and take a punt on that.
And he is somebody who everybody agrees is, like Vieira, is one of the cleverest ex-pros around. And he's such a wonderful interview. Now, if you were to bring Xabi Alonso, imagine the guys he's worked under, right? He's worked under Mourinho, Pep's on-field general, Ancelotti, Rafa Benitez. There you go. Allison's face all lights up when I mention Rafa. Wouldn't it be awesome in Arteta, Xabi Alonso, partnership, co-managers?
He's sensible. I think he's sensible enough that he knows he needs to go away, and I hope he's sensible enough he needs to go away. And, I mean, you know, there's always the right.
Why does Xabi Alonso need to go away and Arteta doesn't?
I mean, Zidane's about to potentially win three in a row, and how much experience has he got? I mean, clearly there are sort of, you know, weird anomalies in all of this, but he did some sort of time learning the ropes. There are anomalies to all this, but I just think, if there is also something specific to Arsenal, which is, it's a big job. You know, it's not just taking over a team that's thriving, or it's not just taking over a team that you know is ready to be sort of have a tweak of the tiller. This is somewhere someone has to come in and just say, right, I know you've been doing this way for the last 20 years, but that's not working for me anymore. You know.
And there is this ridiculous rule in football that if you get rid of one manager, you appoint the opposite. England do it every time, and lots of clubs do it as well. There's like, who's the opposite? Who's the opposite of Arsene Wenger?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Love the game? Then don't miss The Game Daily. It's your lunchtime update from football's finest writers, and it's only at thetimes.co.uk. On Friday night, the two of you and Tony Cascarino took part in a special Times Plus event in Shoreditch alongside former England manager Roy Hodgson. You can hear the live podcast now. It's up there, but here's a sneak peek with Roy giving us his insight into a player who's called up into the England World Cup squad, Ruben Loftus-Cheek.
He's got the chance to be a really, really top player, both at Premier League and international level. And certainly I will stick by the statement that he's one of the best players in midfield I've actually worked with, because he doesn't have any weaknesses. When he's played for 4 or 5 years on the trot and gets up to 20, 25 England caps, then maybe people will say I was right.
The squad itself, no Joe Hart, no Jack Wilshere. Those were the two biggest surprises, I guess, Alison. Were they surprises?
They were controversial in that they were two players who'd been talked about a lot. But they'd been talked about a lot because there was always this possibility that they wouldn't make it, and for very different reasons. Joe Hart ended up having a season where he didn't play very often, which is damning in itself if you can't be the West Ham number one, should you be anywhere near the England squad. But then the debate became, but shouldn't you have Joe Hart there for his experience and the fact he's done these tournaments before? But my argument would always have been, and I back Joe Hart not going, was the biggest criticism of Joe Hart from the Euros was that he was over-emotional and not a great influence. So if you're not the top goalkeeper in club football and you had a poor reputation from the previous big tournament, why would you go? And his stats are poor. There's nothing saying Joe Hart should go. So I don't. It didn't surprise me, but maybe it was brave of Gareth. I like that.
Instead, there's two Burnley keepers, and the one who I think is really good is on the standby list, Tom Heaton. But I guess he's coming back from injury. What about Wilshere? Because Dicko, there seemed to be this argument, the Jack Wilshere argument used to be, okay, England have a lot of central midfielders, but none of them are particularly creative. In fact, I'm looking at this list, and I suppose the most creative England midfielder, once you get past Dele Alli, is Ruben Loftus-Cheek or Jordan Henderson?
We spoke about this at the event on Friday night, and I think...
So what's the explanation here? That would have been the reason to take Wilshere, right? Well, you play somebody who parks the bus, you need somebody who's something clever who can unlock things. Wilshere, or possibly Jonjo Shelvey, could do that, right? Even though they've other failings.
Yeah, well, and there's a certain sadness in leaving Wilshere behind, because he has promised to be something very different for an English midfield, but a couple of big things. One, fitness. I mean, I've seen him... in too many games where I've willed him to look sharper and fitter, and he doesn't. And the England squad, they called him up and marched, examined his fitness then, and he was struggling. And I think you've seen in some big games since, including Europa League semi, when he just does not look to have that mobility. It's simply, and that is a particular problem in the type of midfield that Southgate is setting up, where certainly, you know, the sort of starting team against the likes of Tunisia and Panama, we suspect, will just be one holder, and he'll have effectively two number eights. And he wants them to be very energetic, dynamic. He wants them to basically be in the profile of Lingard, Dele Alli, and Loftus-Cheek. And Wilshere is a very different profile to that. Now, someone may argue, well, that's where you need that point of difference. But I can understand the way that Southgate is developing a pattern. I think he wants, you know, say you have Ali, Loftus-Cheek, Lingard, they're slightly different profiles within that pattern, but Wilshere doesn't fit it, and he certainly doesn't fit it if he's not fit enough. And on the Shelvey, back to that sort of profile of player that he's looking at, I mean, Jonjo Shelvey, you know, the highlights reel of him on Match of the Day every week for the last little while has shown him pinging these lovely passes, and boy, doesn't he, you know, he hit them beautifully, but they tend to be quite deep, quite static passes, and he again doesn't quite fit that profile of the previous players I've mentioned, as well as potentially still questions over what type of tourist he'll be if he's not in the starting 11. So I think, you know, people can argue around all those points, but I understand there is a sort of coherence to Southgate's thinking. I think we can at least
understand the coherence.
We can at least give him that much.
No. I understand the coherence. What I'm not clear on. Look, in the end, you can't conjure players out of nothing, right? If you bring Wilshere and he's crocked or has a bad attitude, or same applies to Shelvey, then there's no point. Looking at the squad, what would concern me, and we've seen this in the last World Cup, if you saw teams like Greece or Costa Rica, teams that are not very good on paper but are very tactically organized, it's like beating your head against the wall unless you have somebody with a spark who can create something out of nothing. And I look at this team. It's not just the midfielders. Other than Raheem Sterling and Dele Alli,
who? I mean, you know, I think he's got a lot to. But I mean, the way, you know, Roy talked about him. I mean, the sort of gushing I was really struck by on Friday. I mean, we do go back to his Loftus-Cheek's debut against Germany for England, and there he was getting the ball, nutmegging. Against the world champions, you know,
so
I know
that's your creative input. Those three guys: Raheem Sterling, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, and Dele Alli.
But or don't get bogged down with the creativity if you haven't got it. We've got other things, England. We've got pace, lots of pace. We've got pace on the wings.
Okay, listen, you can have all the pace in the world, but if the other people put eight people in the box, right? Because that's what you're going to get in certain games.
Well,
then pace is pointless.
I mean, you could argue that. Yeah. Then.
And you lump it to Harry Kane and hope for the best.
Well, quite possibly. I mean, actually, that was. You know, I remember Craig Bellamy at the last Euro saying, you know, England are sort of almost been paying for their own snobbery, that they don't dare just stick on a big guy. And he said, he talked about it many times. He said he's played in teams when, actually, you know, you're playing against a team that are parked eight defenders. And there are different ways, obviously, to approach that. Man City will have their way, as we know. But he said he's played in teams, very good teams, that have actually realised that the only way to draw them out is by swinging in crosses. They have to come out to block those crosses. That creates a bit of space. But, you know, the big man crosses wingers approach is one way around that. So,
and it works. Or it can work if other ways. I just think variety is really important. That would be my concern. I wonder, I don't want anybody to get injured, obviously, in the England team, but on the standby list, there's a guy who probably still needs to prove his fitness, but has been successful before. He's a genuinely creative English player, I think, can be, and he also works hard. And you're smiling because you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, you're setting me up for some silly joke because you want me to say Adam Lallana and you're going to say someone else.
Well, what am I going to say from this list? Jake Livermore? Come on.
Well,
no,
exactly.
Of course.
You're going to say
Adam Lallana. No, I think a fit Lallana.
And they love him. And England love him.
And he's a great teammate, exactly. And Southgate
and
loves him.
So many players do not do it for their country. So many players, well, for England. So many players are just a little bit paler shade of what they should be. For, you know, they just don't have the spark. They just look a bit insipid because they get a bit inhibited. Lallana does not. Lallana looks like he belongs and he really wants to be there. And I agree with you, Gab. Don't want anyone to get injured, but in a way, it could be this weird way it turns out that he ends up going at the last minute and he ends up being star player for England.
All right, enough England. I'm sure we'll speak about them once or twice more this summer. How about some quick hits instead? West Ham part ways with Davy Moyes and Manuel Pellegrini is a name doing the rounds to replace him. Dicko, the odd thing is that there were reports that he was offered a new deal. Can you work this one out, or is it just the unholy trinity doing their thing?
Ah, the unholy trinity. We had that good story, is it, on going into the weekend about James Collins supposedly being told by email that he'd been released after a decade or so.
True.
You know, it's good old West Ham. I mean, one classy move after another. David Moyes does his job. yes, his contract is up for grabs, but one guy comes out, David Golden says, yeah, let's keep him, while the other guy's having tea with another manager. It's a mess. They're going for Benitez, which I think would be a match made in hell, given, you know, a manager who loves control and owners who love to interfere. What a mess.
Big Sam Allardyce has also gone from Everton. Now, there's plenty of names in the frame there, too, including the perennial Marco Silva. But, Alison, should we be more excited by the arrival of uber-hipster Marcel Brands?
The Dutchman. The suave Dutchman. It seems a very convoluted way of trying to get something out of the underperforming player of the season, Davy Klaassen. But he is very highly regarded. We spoke about Chelsea. Do they have a plan? They were linked with him, and he's spotted tons of players and sold them on for money. And I don't know, PSV, in his 8 years there, they won 3 trophies. I don't know, is that a lot or not a lot? But he is regarded very highly, and give him a chance. Yeah, sounds classy.
Pep Guardiola signed a new deal with Manchester City, suggesting that this might not be a 3-and-out situation, as some predicted. Dico, this was inevitable, right?
Well, the new contract or 3-and-out? I mean, I think you know, inevitable. They try and keep him as long as possible. How long he can last with this intensity is all our sort of question fascination. I mean, it was actually Roy Hodgson made another very good point, if I may say so, at the panel where I was gushing about the great football, and as a coach he was saying, yeah, there's the great football, but you know, let's talk about how he makes that team work right to the end of the season, to the very last minute of the season when Jesus scores that goal. He just says he is as much admiring of the relentlessness, absolute relentlessness, of his work and the work he gets out of the players. And we know that has a lifespan. So if he can do more than 3-4 years, great. But we would all still, I think, be a bit surprised.
Yeah, and I think if he needs to replace some of these guys as they run out of intensity, I think he probably has the wherewithal to do it. I also think this idea that like he kind of wears down internally because it takes so much out of him. I think that was true at Barcelona, no doubt, because there's a ton of pressure and he has an emotional bond with there from since childhood. It's possibly true at Bayern because you've got a whole bunch of Germans around you saying, oh, that's very good, but why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? And the team doctor and all this stuff. But at City, he's omnipotent, right? I mean, he can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, well, but it feels that way now. But, you know, you just don't know what other challenges are going to come. But no, I agree. It feels like he's probably got a bit more breathing. It doesn't feel like this summer is going to be, you know, endless headaches. And it feels like the board are, you know, going out of their way to keep him sweet. So, yeah, I mean, maybe, and being a bit older, maybe he can manage himself better. Maybe he can delegate better. But obviously, if he loses Mikel Arteta, then, you know, he's losing the whole driving force of the whole thing, possibly.
Exactly, because he's never won anything without Arteta exactly. By his side, yeah. Mauricio Pochettino, on the other hand, has not signed a new deal yet. Alison, we've debated some of his strange late-season pronouncements. Please reassure the Spurs faithful that everything's going to be fine.
Oh, if they want Pochettino to stay, I'm not sure I can reassure them. Let's remember, he's an incredibly ambitious manager.
Is he?
Yeah, very ambitious. Cast back to when he left Southampton for Spurs. People who knew him were saying, oh, they're not surprised. He wants to win things. And people who know him well will tell you he wants to win trophies, which is why it's hilarious that he says it's not important at Spurs. It is important. He won't. I don't think he wants another Groundhog Day season where he's constantly having to say fourth is good and being in the Champions League is good and he's bringing on young players. He wants to be holding trophies a lot and being credited for that. So I'm not sure he's very long term at Spurs. I think he genuinely likes the idea of the new stadium and making it work, but I don't know. He's ambitious. I think he's bored of lack of investment.
Gigi Buffon and Andres Iniesta play their final games for Juventus and Barcelona, respectively, this weekend. Dico, contextualise their immensity.
In a minute? You must be joking.
No, you don't have a minute. You've got 25 seconds.
Wow.
You've already started.
Buffon, brilliant keeper, amazing. Shame about the ranting nonsense at the end. Iniesta, I think it's much on top of Iniesta's zillion trophies, great things. I think maybe a weird thing to say, but it's the fact of someone of his profile has been such a great player, someone sort of spindly looking, who looked sort of 50 when he was 20. I just think there's something about Barcelona celebrating a player like him and him then thriving in it and becoming this immensity that is almost the most joyous thing, that someone that doesn't really look, almost looks like the opposite of a modern athlete, has become just one of the most wonderful footballers to watch I've seen.
Big debate about whether he's the greatest Spanish player ever, and I struggled to come up with alternatives. Definitely in the conversation. Now, either Fulham or Aston Villa will be promoted to the Premier League. Alison, tell those of us who don't watch the Championship about these two clubs who are going to square off at Wembley in the playoff final on the day that Liverpool chase their sixth European Cup.
Yeah, scheduling nightmare. Fulham went down, lost their Premier League status because they were old, and they have been reinvented under Slavisa as a relatively young, inventive team. We play very, very, very attractive football. Steve Bruce, Aston Villa, has deliberately kept his team old. Their average age is 29 and a half or something. So it's almost the oldies versus the youth. A lot of experienced names that are very recognisable to people who know their Premier League football in the Villa side. Fulham more up and coming, and what on earth will happen to their top players if they don't make it to...
Who'd you rather go on holiday with? Dr. Tony or Mr. Khan? Who'd be more fun?
Shad Khan, the owner. I know Shad Khan.
I know. Would you rather go on holiday with him or Dr. Tony? Him.
Yeah, I think I am actually going on holiday with Shad Khan. So
fantastic.
It's not hypothetical. Gab, I've got a question for you. This is deeply upsetting, but there was no column from you today in the game because it's not back till the World Cup. But if you had written a column today, Gab, what would you have written it about?
I would have written about Paolo Guerrero, who is the captain of Peru, their all-time leading goal scorer, played a huge part in helping them get back to the first World Cup since 1982, and he failed a drug test, this is way back in the autumn, for some metabolite that is a marker for cocaine. He says that it was coca leaves. It's been through several levels of cases. FIFA said, okay, fine, you're going to be banned for 6 months because it's still your responsibility. Probably wasn't performance enhancing, but you should have been more careful. And then WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, because of course they know best, they appealed FIFA's decision. It went to CAS. His ban has now been extended to 14 months, which means he's going to miss the World Cup. A lot of people are completely incensed about this, including a whole bunch of people in football, FIFPro, the Players Union. It is absolutely nonsensical and ridiculous that this guy, having already served a ban, should be left out of the World Cup for, even if he did take cocaine, which he denies and which they accept probably did not happen, that he should miss a World Cup. I think that there's something really wrong with the way WADA operate, and this deserves more attention. I feel really, really bad for Peru and for him and his family. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guest, Alison Rudd, and down the phone from beautiful East Sheen, the place he calls home, it's Matt Dickinson. Remember, it's just £8 for an 8-week trial if you would like to subscribe to our newspaper. You can just search The Times online, and you don't just get our content, which is very good. You also get the Sunday Times content. Now, we're going to be back next Monday after the Champions League final. It's Zidane versus Klopp. It's the reigning champions against the top scorers in the whole tournament. It's Real Madrid against Liverpool. Till then, ta-ta.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.